on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
What is consciousness? You know, it's there are different ways to describe it. I like to think of it as a pervasive field, just like gravity and time are. And it pervades across frequencies, across dimensions. That's why, and with evidence, with using telepathy or remote viewing, you can get information that doesn't exist yet that you'll see in the future, where you can go to the past and get information. So definitely consciousness pervades past, present, and future.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Sean McNamara to discuss his book, Dewdrops of Infinity, Psychedelics, Psychic Abilities, UFOs, and the Buharich Project. In a wide-ranging conversation, Sean discusses the nature of consciousness, out-of-body experiences, lucid dreaming, remote viewing, psychokinesis, and UFOs. He also talks about whether microdosing psychedelics has an effect on psychic abilities. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Sean McNamara, MA, lives in Denver, Colorado, and is a clinical mental health counselor in private practice. He also teaches meditation and consciousness development. In particular, he trains people to access abilities such as telepathy, remote viewing, telekinesis, the out-of-body experience, and more. He is non-religious but takes his exploration of consciousness as his spiritual path. He teaches through in-person events as well as multiple books and online courses available through mindpossible.com. His most recent project involved a year-long study concerning the effects of psychedelics on psychic abilities, and the results are vividly documented in his most recent book, Dewdrops of Infinity, Psychedelics, Psychic Abilities, UFOs, and the Buharich Project. Sean, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nick.
Well, thank you. I am very much looking forward to this. Everything that you write, I find quite fascinating. And I love Dewdrops of Infinity. I like how you share your journal, what you're going through as you're doing the experiments. And I also read your memoir, Renegade Mystic, which I thought was really interesting. But I thought today that we would begin maybe with your background and the journey that you took that got you here. I know there's a lot of ground there, so.
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief enough so it's not too boring. But, I'm a guy who was raised in a Catholic family. And in my childhood, when I was around 7 years old, I had appendicitis. And it burst as they were taking it out of me, so they told me. And that's when I started contemplating death a lot. And I hear it's common that around that age, 7 or 8 years of age, if a child experiences a near-death type of episode, that it becomes a big topic of their life, just how they think about death. And I really thought about it a lot, and I was worried about the afterlife. You know, what happens afterward? And being a Catholic, you know, the church has its own teachings and beliefs. It's a faith-based system. But my personality doesn't really work well with that because I'm very inquisitive. I look for evidence. I want personal experience instead of just being told, this is what we believe. And you were born into this set of beliefs, so that's what you have to believe. It just didn't work for me. And even into my 20s, I struggled against that, even though I was still mostly going to church, even at that age, off and on. And other things happened over the years that brought me a little closer to almost dying. So that theme stayed vivid in my life. And I really wanted to find an answer to that question. So I started studying Buddhism with the idea that maybe something in the Buddhist teachings or through meditation training, I could have some sort of experience that would answer that question for me. And I trained in a particular system of Buddhism in a particular lineage for many years. And All I can say is at the end of that time, I was a pretty good Buddhist, but I hadn't answered any of those questions yet. And I realized that, I've just done a good job adopting these teachings. And people say that Buddhism isn't faith-based, but there are plenty of faith-based aspects of that too. It's a religion, even though people prefer to refer to it as a philosophy. It's a religion if you get up close and personal with it. There's some aspects there. And I was just disappointed because I saw that even Buddhism, like any other religion or corporation or school environment, has the same limitations. And that's people and personalities and issues of control, power, manipulation, money, sexuality, all these things happen there just the way they do anywhere else. And that really brought me to a decision to leave. And I was just fed up with religion after that. Formal religion. But now with spirituality, I was still on my search. I need to know what happens. And so for me, my two religious tracks didn't lead anywhere, or at least well enough for me. So I'm not criticizing them because they're perfectly good religions for the people who they work for. They just didn't work for me. And I remember that when I was in college, I'd picked up a book on how to have a body out of body experience. Written by Robert Monroe or Bob Monroe, written a long time ago. And I was just curious about it because at that age, I was curious in all things weird, you know. But this was the only book that I knew was available. And even though he's a great guy and I love the Monroe Institute, his instructions in that book aren't great. They're just not, they didn't work for me. And it was just one method that he taught. But now, cut to the future, decades later, I thought maybe I could try that again. If I could have an out-of-body experience, that would give me the evidence to some degree that something does continue, that there's part of us that is not physical. And I find that at this point in time, thanks to Amazon and all the bookstores, that there are many books out there these days on how to have an out-of-body experience, offering various methods that you can try so that a person could experiment with different ones and choose the one that they really like. And so I found a book that I really liked, had a lot of methods in it, and I used my discipline gained from years of meditation training, and I applied that discipline to really working at these techniques. And I would train. So I had a job that it wasn't a 9-to-5 job. It was more like an all of the time kind of job, and I could be at home during the day. So I'd often be home for lunch, and after lunch, I could lay on the floor or on the couch and do these visualizations. Then I would train again in bed as I'm falling asleep at night. And then often I would set my alarm for 3 o'clock in the morning and move to the living room and lay on the couch or on the floor and repeat those practices because at that time of night, the body can easily drift back into sleep, but I could keep my mind awake. And that's the perfect formula: body asleep, mind awake for initiating an out-of-body experience. So most days of the week, I was training 3 times a day in those ways, various durations. And after several months of training this way, I had my first out-of-body experience. And like that, my fear of death was gone because I experienced some sense of me apart from my body. And I had more after that. I kept training and training. And so there was a time there I was doing it all the time. I mean, not, I don't mean to make it sound like it was frequent. And it wasn't especially easy for me either. Every time I wanted to have one, I had to train and train and train. And then it would provoke one eventually. It wasn't like I could just lay down and leave my body or anything like that. It just trained and trained and then create the perfect conditions for it to happen, and hopefully it would happen. And it did. And no two were alike. But I learned a lot. And eventually I lost interest in that. I just, you can only do so many. It's like, okay, this is the state of things. And I've answered that question about are we more than just physical beings? But I wanted to find something like that that I could offer people. Because when I was part of a Buddhist tradition, I was teaching at the time. I was a meditation instructor. I just like working with people. And I wanted to find something like this that I could use to work with people, partly because it's fun and it's interesting, but it's also really empowering because in In some religions, like Tibetan Buddhism, to receive certain teachings or practices, you need a teacher's permission, you need a blessing, you need to go on retreat, you have to do full, check off the boxes, and then you're qualified to do this practice. But in terms of parapsychological phenomena, psychic experiences, it's the wild west of consciousness. No rules. And all you need is a good set of instructions, and you can do it. You don't need anyone's blessing or permission, or you don't have to pay a bunch of fees or go on retreat. You get to figure it out for yourself. And so I wanted to offer something like that. And I knew that I could teach people how to have an out-of-body experience, but they wouldn't be able to witness it from the outside because it's a subjective experience. But I came upon this phenomenon of telekinesis, also known as psychokinesis, mind over matter, or moving an object with one's intention. And I saw different people doing it on YouTube, and most of it I thought was BS. Camera tricks or someone thinking that they're doing it, but it's not really the real thing. But I found a few people who I thought, I think this is the real thing. One of them, his name is Trevor Seven. And I thought, this looks real. And so videos like his really inspired me to try and figure it out for myself. And so I like to describe what this kind of telekinesis training is that I did. And it's imagine a piece of tin foil about the size of a gum wrapper, folded over like a tent, balanced on a needle with a big glass cover over it so that the wind doesn't move it. And so I would sit for a long time every day, sometimes more than an hour, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 45 minutes, and just try to move it. And I tried to apply what I knew about meditation. And there are different ways of meditating, but a lot of them have to do with going inside the body or the body mind system or the subtle body and using one's intention and attention to either notice what's going on inside or provoke a change of some type, perhaps for healing or for tuning into the energy. And I thought, okay, I'm going to treat the inside of my body, or I'm going to treat that piece of tinfoil like it's something inside of my body. I'm going to use the same method though. I'm going to put my intention out there, point it at the thing, give it my attention with the intention for it to move, and I'm going to sit and wait and just keep my mind there. And I would try different things too, and some things just didn't work in the end. So I was experimenting a lot mentally, sitting there in front of this piece of tinfoil that was not moving for months. But I kept trying and kept trying. And I noticed changes in myself happening over time that I was learning how to relax because in the beginning I was being too forceful, exerting all this energy, just forcing, trying. And I thought, this isn't good. This doesn't work in meditation. Working hard doesn't work in meditation. It's about letting go. So I started to use that letting go approach to just be present to it and get to know it more. And over time, it started to feel like I and it were not so separate from each other. That sense of distance was dissolving in my mind. And I would develop, breathing technique to help me relax even more and help me feel more connected to the object. Then one night, as I was drifting off to sleep in bed, I was just trying to fall asleep, and suddenly this image of the piece of tinfoil appeared in my mind's eye, like it was right here in the dark. And it was slowly turning. It was just moving back and forth on the needle. And I didn't ask for that. It just came as I was drifting to sleep. And then it was the day after that, or a couple of days after that, when it actually moved for the first time, which is amazing. So I realized, oh, something had to change inside of me before it changed in the outside world. And it was amazing. And I thought, this is something I can show people. Someone could be standing next to me and see it happen. Better yet, I could learn, teach them how to do it themselves and see with their own two eyes. The reason why I believe it's real is because it's not a random movement. It can begin as a random movement, but when I train people, they learn to do in 2 hours what took me months and months and months to learn. And one thing is there is a relationship between the breathing and the body, relaxation and intention, and how the object moves. So I realized when the object was moving, If I got too excited or I started working too hard, it would stop because stress made broke the connection. I would relax again and then it would start moving again. I could also, if it was turning at a standard speed, I could hold my breath a certain way and it would pause. And then I would start exhaling and then it would reverse direction. So on command, I could make a change its behavior that way. And that was the evidence to me that this is not random. Because sometimes if you sit too close, your body heat can easily move through the container and cause it to move. If there's a vibration in the floor or in the table, maybe from deep down in the earth or from the traffic outside, that could cause it to move. But for months, I sat there and the thing would not move. And I was about 2.5 feet away from it. I also learned how to move it from across the room or 10 stories down in the garage sitting in my car. I would do these experiments with cameras running at the same time. I could get it to move from that distance too. And I have all these videos on my YouTube channel. But I could teach people to do that pretty quickly. And that started this whole thing of after that, I would learn how to do remote viewing, which is a form of clairvoyance. And now my latest focus is telepathy. And I really like that because it's social, because telepathy involves two living systems communicating with each other. And there's that community aspect, friendships develop, and that really sense of interpersonal connection. And so now I'm no longer inspired by my fear of death, and I'm pretty much not inspired by my chip on my shoulder about religion. But I'm inspired because it's fun. People, often I'll have energy workers or mediums or psychics who do sessions for other people who have clients. They'll come just for the evidential part of it, just to remind themselves that what they're doing really is effective, that it does help other people, and that it's real. Because we all have doubts. Is this real? If I'm giving someone a reading, am I making it up? What if I'm wrong? So they come and they get really strong evidence, black and white evidence. A telepathy target can be written on a piece of paper. Then they do their drawing and then we compare and they see the evidence, So I really like the more evidential type of things. So that's a long way of saying my fear of death is what propelled me to start teaching people how to explore their consciousness with psychic abilities.
Okay. And you've been working on this for a few decades now, I think. But I have some questions. I want to go back and maybe we can explore some things in terms of the out-of-body experience. I remember Robert Munro's book. I used to have a copy of that I lent to someone and I never got it back. But one of the questions I have is, how do you distinguish between an out-of-body experience and a lucid dream?
Yeah, well, that is the million-dollar question in that realm because a lot of people think they're the same thing. Other people think they're entirely different. These days, I tend to consider them as sections in a spectrum. They're both consciousness-based, as is everything, so that's not a very helpful statement to make. In my personal experience, they're different because lucid dreaming involves a different style of training to provoke the lucid dream. In the waking state, you'll often train yourself to identify or to heighten when you see something strange, really train to notice that so that when something strange appears in a dream, you notice it and that triggers the lucidity. You realize, oh, I'm in a dream because I just saw a gorilla across the street. And I checked, I did a state check. So a person could train themselves to, when something strange happens in regular life while they're awake, to look at their hands or look at their watch. So every time that happens, they look. And in the dream, when that thing will happen, they'll look at their watch in the dream, right? And they might notice that the numbers of the watch don't look like numbers anymore. But they look at their hands and one is a crab claw or something. Or they just looking at their hands and go, I'm doing this thing. Oh, yes, I'm in a dream. The dreams have a particular quality to them. They're dreamlike. Sometimes they're more vague than the waking state. Sometimes they could be as vivid as the waking state. But you need to fall asleep in order to dream. And sometimes you're asleep for quite a while before you enter the next REM stage of any sleep cycle. Now, to provoke an out-of-body experience, you also use visualization techniques that you might do as you're falling asleep. That you could either enter the out-of-body state without losing consciousness, that your body falls asleep, but you stay awake, which is similar to the wild technique in lucid dreaming, where you just go straight into dream state. You fall asleep and you're dreaming, but you never lost consciousness. But you could black out when training for an out-of-body experience. You could black out momentarily, or the out-of-body experience could happen later. Or you could go directly into the out-of-body experience. But there's this thing called the vibrational state that's a clear sign. It's a standard part of developing the out-of-body experience. But it's a troubling phrase, though, the vibrational state, because it's not always a vibration. Classically, and I think Robert Monroe even described this in his experience, it feels like these waves are moving up and down your body, or a rushing feeling, or an electrical buzz feeling, moving from the top of your head to the tips of your toes and back. It can be very subtle and soft, it can be rough. But the vibrational state can involve auditory hallucinations. Like you might hear the footsteps of someone walking around the room. And someone who's not trained or educated might think, there's a ghost in my room. But it's really just your brain producing these hallucinations. Sometimes it can sound like someone fired a gun next to your ear, this gunshot sound. Or there could be sensations on the body, like it might feel like someone's touching you, touching your arm, touching your feet, pulling on your legs a little bit. These are all sensory hallucinations. And I think it's connected to the brain, the physical consciousness is trying to figure out what the non-physical consciousness is trying to do. Or it's a unique state of being. So we have different states of awareness of being wide awake, being in a semi-trance or in a trance, like when you're driving on the highway or under hypnosis, meditation, starting to fall asleep, dream and sleep, and then deep sleep, delta level sleep, where you're blacked out, or being under the influence of a drug or alcohol. The brain is familiar with those. But this thing about trying to leave your body on purpose, that's unusual. So I think these hallucinations come on because the brain is just trying to make 2 + 2 = 4 and is having a hard time, or because some part of you is signaling like it's about to happen. You're about to leave, and this is the way we let you know. I don't know for sure which one it is. It's unusual, but that's what I think makes it distinct from the experience of a lucid dream. And there might be lucid dreamers out there who also feel the vibrational state. So I could be wrong there. But in my personal experience, when I have lucid dreams, I don't have the vibrational state. When I leave my body, these days it's rare because I don't train for it anymore, but sometimes it happens spontaneously. Sometimes the vibrational state is very, 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 very subtle. And sometimes it's not there at all. And I've read that in other texts that the vibrational state is often strongest when someone is first learning to develop this ability, but after a while, they don't need it as much and it doesn't occur as strongly. So that's the main difference for me, is that the vibrational state, the clues that it's about to happen is different. But also the out-of-body experience does have a different quality. Once I'm out, the environment may resemble the room I'm in, or it could be that the room could look different. And I think that's because when we're no longer perceiving reality through our physical eyeballs, talking to our physical brain, mind, non-physical mind, has to come up with some sort of parallel. Because of my conditioning as a human being in this lifetime, I'm used to seeing things with my eyes. But in the out-of-body state, no more eyes, but my mind has to try and recreate a visual scene because that's what Sean is used to in his body. Like one time I left and I turned back and looked on the couch, and I knew that my body was laying on its side a certain way. That's how I did the technique. But when I looked, my body was flipped in the other direction. It's like, oh, well, my mind got that wrong. But sometimes it'll have me wearing a different colored shirt than I was wearing while I was sleeping. Because the mind is just trying to get something across. It's not always perfect. The interesting thing too is there could be a mixture of the room is pretty darn close to how it really is, but there are other things in there that are not in the room, but they're like thought objects. their ideas that are manifesting in the out-of-body state. So in the out-of-body state, it could be, it's all mind, right? If we just consider consciousness as everywhere, it's just we've dissociated the sense of me being here.
Right.
We've moved it out there. A lot of depictions of the out-of-body state are like your spirit's leaving, and it looks just like your body, but it's glowing and it's leaving. And that's why they call it the out-of-body state, that you're leaving your body. But I think there's a more sophisticated approach that many people have developed, and that I agree with, that we're not even in our body now. We're just consciousness. All pervasive consciousness is perceiving itself through these eyes right now, but it's also there, and it's also there, and it's also there. So when I seem to leave my body, nothing's leaving. I'm just changing my point of perception to some locus outside of the physical coordinates of where my body is in the room. I'm just moving my perception from here to over there, but nothing is left. So for me, those are the and so in the lucid dream state, I'm not also nothing is left. I'm still definitely perceiving from the brain for sure, because the random eye movement stage, that's when dreams are produced. So that's all in here versus seeing a different version of reality through consciousness in the out-of-body state. So
Yeah, I like that model a lot. It makes a lot of sense to me of that there's nothing really leaving. You're just shifting the point of perception, I guess, or the point within consciousness. I know that like in Robert Monroe's work, he talks about often that there's this sort of silver thread that connects the astral body to the physical body. And it doesn't seem like you're experiencing anything like that. And the model that you're providing, it wouldn't make sense for that to be there.
Right. So much of this, I think, is shaped by culture and by what beliefs one adopts when they're training to have the out-of-body experience. And so you see the silver cord thing. And I remember when I was a kid, right before I got Robert Monroe's book, before that, I watched that movie Out on a Limb. It was a TV series
With
based on
Shirley
Shirley
MacLaine.
MacLaine's thing, and I loved it. It's got everything in it. It's a beautiful, and you can see it on YouTube. It's out there, or at least it used to be. So anyone out there, it's a TV series from the 80s, all things spiritual. It's really well done. It's beautiful. And in the one scene, she's in a hot spring in Peru at night with her male companion, and she's looking at a candle flame, and she starts to relax. And then she experiences herself leaving the body and moving up into space, and she experiences a silver cord. Well, we could say that from the 1800s or mid-1800s to the 1980s, this thing about the silver cord was pretty well known in these circles. It was just, that's what you see. And because in the out-of-body state, we can see things that are actually there or symbols of them, we can also see things that aren't really there, but that we believe should be there, will create these thought things. So I think, like, these days, if someone sees a silver cord, it's not because there's really a cord there. It's because they read books telling them that there's supposed to be a silver cord, or they saw it in a movie somewhere. So it just shows how powerful belief is. We all have our different version of reality. There's no objective reality. Now, while we're awake in this world, the physical world, it really makes things seem objective because everything slows down. We've got ordinary time, gravity, physical bodies with limitations, which is nice because then we can have a life. These limits are a gift to get, let us have boundaries and experience things. But out there, without the physical, everything's faster or beyond time. But we can make things up. Imagine if anything we believed in would suddenly appear in our room. This world would be chaos, So yeah, the silver cord is not a big deal for me. There may have been one, I can't remember now. There may have been one time where I thought I saw something, but no. And it's not, and there have been times that I've seen myself in a humanoid form. There have been times that I've been out with no form at all. I'm just seeing what's out there, but I've got no body. And things like that. So it can happen in different ways because, again, there's not a thing The sense of self
Right.
is a thing, it's a process.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't make sense to me for there to be that silver cord based on how you understand this anyway. But you say that you like the you want evidence. You're an evidence guy, which I appreciate. What was the evidence for you that convinced you that you had, in fact, left your body?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Like, of all the psychic stuff that I've done and trained people to do, this is the least evidential for sure. It's almost, I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to say that. I believe it's real, but it's the least evident. It's like non-evidential because there are times when I had the feeling of leaving my body. There's a technique called the rollout technique where you practice rolling in your bed, and then when you're ready, you roll out and hit the floor softly, but you still, gravity seems to have a hold, but it's a belief. And then test and look around like, oh, well, there's my body in bed and I'm out here and it looks like my bedroom. And I remember one time I did that. I rolled out of my body, so to speak. It's just a mind's representation. And I go out to the balcony. I walk right through the glass doors to the patio, which is a strange sensation to move through glass or move through walls. You feel it. It's very weird. Move through, and I'm on the 10th story of my building. And then I just leapt off the edge and I just sink down safely, slowly, hit the ground. And the outside looks like a different place. There are times when I left my body and there, well, I'll keep it specific. I left. Fly out the window. And that's the great thing about out-of-body experiences and lucid dreaming is flying is the best experience. You actually feel it. It's like a thrilling, blissful feeling in the physical body as well. It just feels so delightful to fly. So I fly through the window and suddenly I'm over a village. I'm up high in the sky. And it's not a village like my neighborhood. It's somewhere else entirely. And so weird things like that can happen where the environment totally changes and offers no possibility of evidence that you're in your that it's real or that's your local environment. That it raises a ton of questions about other realities or that consciousness is really unlimited, that we really produce the environments that we want to be in, or is there some randomness involved? Also, is higher self involved, or is some other being, sense of consciousness involved? One thing that I've heard before, and I think it might be true that sometimes some deeper aspect of ourself or of myself, when I'm trying to have an out-of-body experience, maybe my higher self, I'll just use that phrase, they're the one who's really deciding what I'm going to experience. It's not going to give me what I want, it's going to give me what I need as the next step. And I found that actually there are two ways when you're having the out-of-body experience, two ways you can go. You can try and control the experience, or you can hand over the reins, which really means letting go and trusting the experience itself that something will happen. But like, for example, I used to want to just get out and stay in the bedroom or stay in the living room to try and get some proof. But when I let go, sometimes I'll find myself in another spiritual dimension, having a really beautiful experience. I go, well, that was much better than just hanging out in my living room. But I never could have guessed of an environment like that. I never could have imagined it. But some part of me or someone, some other being, someone, maybe a spiritual friend, drew me there without me knowing it. So.
Yeah, I personally, I think that for me, there would be a sense of fear that I wouldn't be able to get back. And so I appreciate that you say there is this element of trust, because it seems like the trust is a counter to the fear. Have you ever felt like you may not be able to get back?
No, it's actually that's the hard part is most out-of-body experiences that I've had and that I've read about other people having are very brief. They're always too
Oh,
brief.
yeah.
You get out and you have to stay cool, stay calm while you're out, because if you get emotionally excited or overstimulated, you immediately return to the body. And sometimes it feels like you're moving back, and sometimes it's instant. So in Because we're talking about non-physical consciousness able to traverse vast distances, it doesn't take any time. It's instant because we're entangled with the whole universe anyway. So instantly we come back. It's staying out longer. That's hard to do. And you can train at it. And there are different ways to keep you grounded in each environment so you stay there longer. But I know a lot of people are afraid of they might not come back, especially with the silver cord thing, because there was that additional thing. If it breaks, you'll die. What is this, Nightmare on Elm Street? It's not like that at all. It's staying out is hard, coming back is super easy. The second you become afraid in the out-of-body state, you'll come back. And that's just a safety mechanism. The heightened emotion will bring you back and you'll feel safe again in your body. You might still feel a little scared about whatever you saw or something, but there's no danger. I don't want to say we're powerful beings because we're not powerful in many ways, but there is a protective mechanism involved with moving your consciousness around. You're not going to kill yourself. Something I always like to share about fear is I was scared the whole time I was training for it. A lot of it was the auditory hallucinations when it sounded like someone was walking around in the room or it felt like someone was touching me. Am I tuning into, spirits or other types of beings or what else is out there in the non-physical realm that now that I'm trying to enter the non-physical, maybe they're standing there waiting for me. And maybe they don't have the best intentions. So I'd get scared that way. And the only way I figured out to deal with the fear was to meet it every time. I'd train and train and train, get scared, and realize nothing bad ever happened. So I'd just train and train and train until I got bored instead of scared, which is a surefire way to deal with fear. Don't let it stop you from training, but keep training and you'll realize there's nothing that's going to hurt me. There's nothing to be afraid of. On social media, there's tons of people trying to scare other people because that's how you can easily get attention from others is by putting out fearful beliefs. You can meet that fear over and over again until you get bored. And then that's when you go a little further into the out-of-body experience. Each time, you got to overcome it through boredom, and then you get a little further.
Yeah. Do you think that since you train people in this, is here the auditory hallucinations or the fear, and I, that's probably not the right way to the right language there, but those auditory experiences you mentioned, like hearing a gunshot or voices or something, or feeling something, is that something that people can work with in terms of if they have that experience, they can then say, aha, this is part of the path. This is part of the process.
Yeah, I think part of it is that if they had a list ahead of time when they were training, like, by the way, these are things that could happen. Like in Renegade Mystic in the back, there's instructions for how to train for it in the second edition. It tells you this is the weird kind of stuff that you might encounter along the way. So when it does happen, it won't be a surprise and they won't develop an unhelpful belief system about it because they could have an experience, then Google it. And then someone on YouTube is there telling some scary story, and now they have that belief. So having a list ahead of time of what to expect when you're expecting to leave your body, things that could happen, and then it won't prevent them from happening, but when they happen, you'll know. And then you might still feel your heart racing when it sounds like something exploded next to your head. Or another one is it can sound like there's a 747 jumbo jet engine in your room or a train right outside. Sounds can happen. It'll raise your heart rate. And then that'll, if you were about to leave your body, it's not going to happen now because your body's just too excited. But then I would recommend lingering there. Try and relax again and keep trying. Can you train yourself to drop down into the relaxed state? And that'll also help overcome the spontaneous fear that can come up when we hear those sounds. We have to train ourselves out of that type of response.
Yeah, I was curious because I've experienced all of those, and I wouldn't say that it was fear, but more of a shock, I think. And it's that shock then that typically will wake me up or take me out of that experience. So I was very curious. So What do you think is the connection of between, for example, out of body experience and something like remote viewing?
What's the connection between them?
Yeah, because it seems like there's got to be some kind of connection. It almost seems like with remote viewing, you're doing something very similar that you're, and I don't know, I've never done this, but it seems like you're putting your consciousness somewhere else.
Well, so remote viewing, it's been around for decades, and there are different ways to do it. In a general level, it's a protocol for using clairvoyance. But some people, so let me start with the out-of-body experience. In the out-of-body experience, there's a sense of you leaving the body. That's how it's experienced. Whether or not that's actually happening, that's how it's experienced. And then once you're out, you can move around whatever environment you're in and you can go explore. With remote viewing, there are at least these two approaches a person could take depending on what they've learned and their training. One is you set your intention to perceive the target, and that target may have a coordinate number associated with it, like a six-digit random number that is a symbolic of the target. So you focus on that number, like, I want to receive information connected to this number. But then at a certain point in that protocol, you just wait. You let the information come to you and you're wide awake in your body. The information starts to come and arise in your consciousness. And that's when you start writing things down, depending on what style you do. Some have different stages you go through. So that's one style. You don't leave your body, information comes to you. Another style is there is a sense that you're going to the location, the target location, that you're going there. And some people actually experience themselves like they're actually there. And then they're getting visual cues, they're hearing noises that are there. You can even taste and smell things that are in that target site that they're trying to perceive. And then when they're done, there's a sense of getting out of there and coming back to the sense of self. The first style, I think, is a lot easier to learn. I mean, I teach people that all the time, and it can be done in 15 minutes if you want it to be that brief about it and get the evidence that they actually saw the target. The other way, I think, takes a little bit more. I don't teach that way, but many people do. And it's a great way. It's just, I think it might just, it has to appeal to a person. So those are at least two generally different ways of doing remote viewing. So there's some similarities there. At the root, they're all consciousness based. This is just conscious. What is consciousness? There are different ways to describe it. I like to think of it as a pervasive field, just like gravity and time are. And it pervades across frequencies, across dimensions. That's why, and with evidence, with using telepathy or remote viewing, you can get information that doesn't exist yet that you'll see in the future, where you can go to the past and get information. So definitely consciousness pervades past, present, and future. And that's so, and that can be true with the out-of-body experience as well. You
Right.
can seek the intention to go to the past, present, or future. In terms of evidence, though, even though I haven't had some strong evidence or really any significant evidence with the out-of-body experience, it has been found by others. I always like to bring out the example of the study involving Miss Z. That was just a pseudonym given to her. I think the experiment was run by Dr. Charles Tart, Tart. And his experiment where he wrote a set of words or numbers on a piece of paper, set it up high in a room, and then they had someone having an out-of-body experience. And this one woman successfully left her body, floated up, saw what was written on the paper, and reported it when she returned to her body with 100% accuracy. But still, we could ask, was she using clairvoyance at all? Which remote viewing is rooted in clairvoyance.
Right.
Like, what is the difference between clairvoyance and the out-of-body experience, or telepathy and the out-of-body experience? It's in at some level, it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just how we
Yeah.
approach it with a conscious mind is different.
Right. Yeah, I've got a copy of Charles Tart's I think his very first book on altered states of consciousness. I'm looking at it right now. I was going to review it before speaking with you today, but I didn't. My focus was on a little bit on Stan Grof and his, I think it's his first book, Realms of the Human Unconscious, where he, and we'll get to this, where I'm not done with this line of questioning yet, but he does talk about psychedelics and things like ESP and whatnot, that these things were reported. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, but the idea has been there. But back to the experiment, I also know that there was a hospital, I forget where, that was doing something similar where they had on top like a filing cabinet, something. And this was in, I think, the cardiac unit where it had this random phrase. And they were using that to try to verify that someone who had this near-death experience that claimed to have left their body to see if they could, read what was up there. And I remember some skeptic was like, well, no one has ever successfully read that and reported back. And my thought was, if it's the first time I've left my body, I'm going to be way more into that than looking at what's on top of a filing cabinet.
That's often the case. We might try and experience you go out of body with a certain intention in mind, but once you enter that state, your mind is different. One's mind is different, and it has other desires, other curiosities. So the experiment, whatever, that doesn't mean anything. I want to go over here and talk to this person who's standing in this magical place. Oh yeah, but you mentioned the near-death experiences. They're full of evidence for the out-of-body state. Coming back, and they know exactly who was in the waiting room down the hallway. They know what doctors in another room were saying. They know all this stuff and they write it down. And, there's so much evidence there. It's just the pseudo skeptics say there's no evidence. There is. They just refuse to look at it. They deny its existence, but there's plenty of it.
Yeah, I always point that out that I'm supposed to teach in critical thinking pseudoscience. And one of the logic books I have, the author just flat out says, in terms of things like ESP, well, there's no evidence. And I'm like, but there is. And I cannot, in good conscience, stand in front of students and say, no, there's no evidence, because that's just indoctrination at that point. And I'm not supposed to be teaching indoctrination. I'm supposed to be teaching critical thought, right? And so exploration, I think, is part of critical thought, and following it wherever it takes you.
Yeah, that's the real science, is testing things out, trying things out.
So you had mentioned briefly, I wanted to ask you about this in terms of the out-of-body experiences. And I know that you write about this a little bit. About, I don't know if the language is other entities, maybe I should say other consciousnesses. I know at one point that you describe, I think, running into like a little girl or something, and you sort of recognize that she's also having this out of body experience. So, what can you say about these other consciousnesses that you encounter?
Yeah, it's it that is the most beautiful thing for me in the out of body state to meet someone else out there. Yeah, there was one where there was a little girl, and there's such a strange familiarity sometimes with these beings. There was one, I don't know if I ever wrote about this one, there was a little boy involved. And with that one, there was a sense of I've known you. I know you on some other level, or maybe in another lifetime, or somehow I know you. And this love, like big love, bigger than is like to feel that kind of love in this life, in the waking state, is really rare and difficult. This kind of love in the out of body state is, I can't put words, it's big, big love. For some kid who I'm like, I don't know where or how I know you, but I know you and you know me. And it's the feeling's mutual. That's like, oh, we've been connected before. Was he my son in another life? Or was I his son? Or were we brothers or best friends? Who knows? But these out-of-body interactions with other beings, they're like beautiful, sometimes reunions. Like, oh, we get to visit here in between lives. How you doing? Still love you, by the way. Like this love is eternal. And where I've come back and I'm just in tears, right? Like my heart can't handle hold the amount of love that is possible in the out-of-body state. So, and it's not like that with every being that I see out there. There's some that's like, well, you're kind of interesting or weird, but I don't feel love for you, but let's try and communicate a little bit here. Yeah, so it's a really special experience. And who are they? I don't know. And they haven't all been human.
Yeah.
So, I've had a very intimate interaction with some, I guess I'll just use the word extraterrestrial. If it may not be an accurate term, but it wasn't a human.
Yeah.
And we had an intimate sexual type of experience that ended up giving me some, what I would call a Kundalini experience. Just everyone knows what that means, so I'll use that word, although I'm not sure if that's what really happened. And I don't know why it happened. So I could make guesses, but they would just be guesses. But so, it can get very personal
Yeah.
with other beings in the out-of-body state, just as it can in lucid dreaming or ordinary dreaming too.
Right.
And
Well, and I know that in some traditions, I'm trying to avoid saying shamanic, but in some traditions where altered states of consciousness are elicited, through drumming, maybe, whenever the practitioner enters into this altered state, sometimes these beings give teachings. It seems to be recognized almost like you're doing this for spiritual lessons of sorts. And given that, have you experienced anything like that? I mean, it seems like this has been a huge lesson for you ongoing, but has there been like specific, I don't know, teachings or anything that have been presented to you?
early on, I had a brief series of out-of-body experiences that appeared to be learning environments, almost like classrooms or training rooms. And we were practicing different things, like different ways of moving in the out-of-body state. So there would be a teacher and then a bunch of us there training, which is really interesting. But I can't recall like a specific, like a spiritual teaching that was given in those
Yeah.
environments. The one interaction with a non-human being that was sexual, where there, ended up shooting energy up my spine and everything. I suspect that there was a teaching transmitted then, but non-verbally. And I think if that's what happened, it's been unfolding since then, probably through the work I've been doing since then. I think it planted a seed, and the seed is sprouting through information I bring out and publish. Like I'm out here learning these things than just sharing it with people through my books and online courses. So
Yeah.
these beings are giving me stuff, or they're
Yeah.
provoking me in certain ways
Yeah.
to go this direction, explore, and then share what I learned, go explore over here and share.
Right.
And part of that, though, in receiving information is being in the twilight state, or almost everything I've done in terms of consciousness exploration for the last 8 or 10 years has come to me either in a dream state or out of body state, but mostly laying in bed in the middle of the night or in meditation late at night. And these ideas just come. Like, I didn't make this up, but it's a great idea. In one of my books, the whole table of contents appeared to me over a couple of nights. And I'd go to my whiteboard and just write it down the next night, and other more would come. I'm like, well, there's the next book. And I knew what would fill it. Something told me how to structure it, So now I am skeptical enough to say, look out, Sean, I'm putting this authority on some outer being. I'm like crediting some force out there who I don't even know what it is. It is just as possible that the world's most powerful supercomputer, the human brain, is producing this information and delivering it to me through my subconsciousness into my conscious awareness in the middle of the night. We are powerful. The brain is a tremendously miraculous organ, capable of so much more than we know. So even though I sometimes credit these things that come to me, they seem to come from somewhere else. It could just be coming from the brain. So, because I don't know, I'm very, for me, the sense of spiritual authority is really important. And I don't want to disempower myself or disempower others by saying automatically, someone gave that to you. There's no way you do that yourself. No. No, humans are wonderful creatures. We can do a lot of amazing things. So it's just my soapbox.
That's okay. That's okay. I find it's actually quite refreshing. And I think it's something often many of us need to keep in mind in terms of religion that, the foundation ought to be our own personal subjective spiritual experiences rather than whatever an outside authority tells us. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. So let's move on to Dew Drops of Infinity and the Puharich project. I think the first thing I want to ask is about the name Puharich. And I know it's a person. So could you say a little bit about who this was and why you named this project after them?
So Andrea Puharich was a scientist and a researcher. He did things like developing a hearing aid, making inventions. He had an invention for splitting water molecules for energy, things like that. So brilliant guy. He was in the army when he was a young man. He was a doctor. Actually, that's his main thing, was that he was a medical doctor. And but he would do different kinds of research. And even in the army, at one point, one of his superiors asked him about if he had found out, he had been doing research into plants and mushrooms, if any of these things could improve someone's psychic abilities. And his superior said, because if you find something out about that, the army would be quite interested to know. And that was about 20 years before the remote viewing program, which the army and the CIA were involved in, before that happened. So they've been interested in these abilities for much longer than most of the public are aware of. So he did research with the Amanita muscaria mushroom, and I think also with psilocybin, to see how that would affect one's psychic abilities. He inspired me because in some of my other work and projects, I'd read his other books about psychic development. I knew he had written this book called The Sacred Mushroom, but at the time I was like, I don't care about mushrooms. I don't need to know about, I'm not going to read that book, which is a big mistake. Because the book talks about his experiences working in person with psychics and with psychedelics. But I guess everything comes in due time. So at one point, a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago, I came upon a YouTube video about this old show called One Step Beyond. It's from the 1960s in black and white, sort of like the Twilight Zone. And most of their episodes were fictional. But this one episode I saw called The Magic or called The Sacred Mushroom, the same title as the book he wrote later on, documents his trip to Mexico with a team of doctors and scientists to encounter the mushroom, the psilocybin mushroom. And he has spoken, I believe, with Gordon Wasson, who had also been to Mexico. They go there, they encounter shamans who are involved with the mushroom, and they test them on their clairvoyance, their ability to foresee things and to find stolen donkeys, which they can do using the mushroom. And it's a beautiful video to watch. It's still available on YouTube. Just Google One Step Beyond the Sacred Mushroom. And it's about 20 minutes long. The first half of the episode shows him in Mexico. The second half shows him in his lab in somewhere in California with a show host. And he gives the show host some mushrooms to eat. And you watch the show host come under the influence of psilocybin. And then he tests him on different psychic abilities. And he seems to exhibit more psychic potential under the influence of the mushroom. And so I've read this guy's books. I see this video of him. I've read one of his books where he spent a lot of time with Uri Geller. They were having contact with UFOs and experiencing strange phenomena. So this guy's inspired me in different ways. He was a strange man for sure in his personal life. I mean, everyone's strange, I guess. But in terms of his thirst for research and for experiences. I share that with him. So I saw that video from One Step Beyond. I started to wonder, could I do that? Well, maybe I can test myself. And at the time, I was not a user of psychedelics or other substances, except drinking a glass of wine once in a while. And I told a friend of mine about what I was planning to do, and she said, I'm in. Her name's Donna Rebido, great friend. So she spurred something on. So I ended up inviting other people, other friends to participate. And I designed this 6-month experiment initially. It was going to be a microdosing experiment. And three of us were going to microdose psilocybin and Amanita muscaria. And the other five were going to be control subjects. And every week, we all had to do 3 to 4 different psychic tests. And these are tests that you could be rated on a scale so we could measure improvement. And I decided to name the project the Puharich Project after him, after Andrea Puharich. And I believe that there's a documentary about him that's going to supposedly come out later this year or next year. It'll be called Mind Traveler. I think that's the working title. So more will come out about him. That's really interesting. So we did that experiment for 6 months, microdosing, and I measured their results. Then at the end, I thought, well, I have all the psilocybin because I had to learn how to grow it. I didn't have a supplier, right? But luckily, it's quite easy to grow. So I grew my own, and you can order Amanita muscaria online. That's legal to order it online because nobody eats it. Everyone thinks it's going to kill you. It's not. And that's still the current belief for the general population. So we don't have to bother to make it illegal. But I got some of that and turned it into a tincture to supply the study's participants. And I had a great experience microdosing. It actually lifted me out of lifelong depression that I wasn't even aware that I had. One day I woke up after about 5 weeks of microdosing, and I felt like a normal person. I was like, I talked to my wife about it, described how I feel. I said, is this how normal people feel? She's like, that's normal, Sean. I'm like, well, for me, it's really happy. She's like, no, that's normal. That's a normal level of happiness. And I'd been living my life down here, and I didn't even know it. So I was grateful to the mushroom for doing that for me through microdosing. And of course, it's in the news, and there's so many studies now about psychologically wonderful. But I thought, I've got all these mushrooms laying around. I would kick myself for not taking the extra step of taking large hallucinatory doses of these substances, putting myself through the same tests. So over the next 6 months, I not only took psilocybin in larger doses, or Amanita muscaria, but I took LSD, LSA, which is like a cousin, molecularly speaking, to LSD. And DMT, and I learned how to extract it, and I extracted my own DMT. I joke with my wife that it's sort of like a scene from Breaking Bad, all this equipment and in the kitchen, and I've got the fire extinguisher nearby in case I start a fire. But even that's quite easy to extract. So I extracted my own DMT. So I did spent 6 months going on journeys with these substances, and then while journeying, taking ESP tests and telepathy tests, which is hard work to do. The whole time, all I want to do is lay down and go on a trip. It's so hard, but I did it. And I think that's also thanks to my meditation training, how to work with the mind, especially when the mind is feeling pretty weird. Can I still be stable? Can I work through it? And meditation trains you how to do that. So I credit my meditation training to help me with that and just get through the tests. So that's the Puharich Project. That the book Two Drops of Infinity is based on. Lots of weird things happened outside of the test, though. I
Such
think,
as
yeah, it's like one thing I realized back when I was doing the telekinesis is you can't just open the door of psychic perception or psychic influence a little bit just for that one thing. You open the door and anything can happen, right? So, for example, one day, and this is in the 6 month period when I've been doing large doses. I was driving across Denver in rush hour, and I needed to pull over somewhere to use the restroom. And so I pulled into a Starbucks coffee shop, and it's one I'd never been in before. And it was very small. There was just a few tables, maybe a couple of people sitting down having their coffee. So basically empty. There were two baristas. And there was one person waiting in line for their coffee, and I was standing in line. The guy orders his coffee and goes away, gets his coffee, sits down. But so then I place my order. I might be forgetting the story a little bit, but I'm standing there, place my order. The barista's got his back to me, and I see this blue flash of light appear down at the level of my knee. Just this blue pops up. So I see it in my peripheral vision and I look down. Actually, I didn't look down. I ignored it. That's what I, at first I ignored it. But then I hear this scraping sound, like it's moving. Whatever that thing was, it was moving. It was moving behind my foot. And I was like, I better look at this. You know, sometimes we notice things, but we don't really pay attention. So we just let it go. I've had keys fall out of my pocket that way, and I just ignore the sound of the keys falling. And later on, I realized that's what that sound was my keys falling out of my pocket. So I look down, and there's this beautiful blue glass bead behind my foot. And it was the same color of light that flashed initially. And I get my coffee. The guy eventually gives me a coffee, and I spent minutes at least scouring the Starbucks. Like, I thought this was from a display case. Is there a bowl of blue beads somewhere? I'm looking up at the ceiling. Did it fall from there? Did it fall from the beverage counter? There was no other blue bead anywhere there. There was no decorative item. And why would it have appeared like in space instead of the other thing, too, was after it appeared, I heard a, you know, before I heard the scraping sound, it was a just a tap. Just a tap. But after that, sometime after that, I would show it to people. And there were a couple of times when it would fall on the floor, on my ceramic tile floor, and it bounces. And one time I dropped it on purpose on concrete, and it bounces. It bounces a lot. But when it came to me, it just landed and scraped like it was being moved. Didn't behave as if it had just fallen from the ceiling, it would have bounced. It did not bounce, which is really interesting. So I'm familiar with apports, APPORT, that often happen or tend to be known for happening in mediumistic seances. That these objects are being sent by spirit from some other domain. And they can send crystals, rocks, coins, flowers, pictures, all sorts of stuff have been known to show up at a seance, you know, these apports. And so I believe it was an apport. One reason I believe it was because I'd been listening on the radio on YouTube in the car to an old interview with a woman named Jean Millay, who was involved in the initial years of remote viewing. She knew some of the scientists involved. She was part of the experiments. And I know some of my friend Gail Hazen, she has her own show, but she was friends, dear friends with Jean. But I was watching her this video, listening to it in the car, and the interviewer was talking to her about belief systems, and Jean was starting to talk about the difference between children and adults. Then I stop at the Starbucks, I pause the video, and when I get back in the car afterward and press play, Jean starts talking about how we need as adults to be more like children, to be more open-minded and believe these very strange phenomena that can occur, that we are multidimensional beings. Because when I saw that blue bead and I picked it up, even though I thought maybe it's an apport, most of me denied. I was like, this, it can't be. It can't be. Even though I've had out-of-body experiences, I've done remote viewing, I've taught people how to do telepathy, I've got all this evidence behind me, all these experiences, I still doubt it when it occurs, especially when it's something I've never seen before. Some part of my brain just doesn't like this woo-woo stuff. I'm not all in. So I struggle against myself all the time. But the apport, and now I've given in, I'm like, yeah, it was an apport, Sean. Don't be such a jackass. But I really believe that that's what it was. Of course, can't really prove it, but so that's my personal belief, and I accept that it's just a belief. But I've seen some things, man.
Well, you know, it could also, it seems like it also fits into synchronicity, given what you were listening to in your car.
Well, I wonder if it wasn't Jean Millay who sent me that bead. So
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
maybe.
Yeah, I can't tell. So I don't want to give away the conclusion of Dewdrops of Infinity.
We can give it. I wouldn't mind if you want to give it away. It's up.
Okay. Well, you give a lot of the, what I appreciate is that you have the results of the regular tests that people were doing. But if for nothing else, people can read the book for that. And there's a lot of other valuable information. And like I said before, I found it very entertaining in the sense that you were also describing your providing your journal entries or some journal entries. So it's definitely worth reading for that and for those insights. So if you don't mind giving it away, what was your conclusion with the Puharich project in terms of psychedelics and psychic phenomena?
Yeah. So, because I watched that video from the One Step Beyond, and there the host seemed to suddenly become psychic after eating a couple of mushrooms, right? So my hypothesis that I was testing was that it will increase these people's abilities. And so after 6 months of microdosing, and it took me a long time to tabulate the scores, turns out their results were very psychic, but the results of the people who didn't take mushrooms were also very psychic.
Right. Yeah. You had a
So
control group.
the control
Yeah.
group was also very psychic, but the people who took the mushroom in microdoses were not noticeably more psychic than the control. And in the book, there's pictures, right, of their transcripts and the targets. So you can see the evidence there, like, wow, this is pretty amazing stuff. And you're like, I think this is someone on mushrooms. Nope, it's someone who's not taking them. So then, with the 6 months where it was just me on large doses, large enough to hallucinate, I should say that because for me, I'm a pretty sensitive person. And for me, even a dose of 0.5 gram to 1 gram of psilocybin will send me over the moon. I'll see things, you know. So it doesn't have to be 5 grams or whatever you hear about on social media. It doesn't have to be that much to produce the hallucinogenic state. But for me, my results were good. I don't know if they were much better than they would have been without the substance, but they were consistently good. Normally, over 6 months, I'd have ups and down days. And there weren't a lot of tests either. So the test isn't great. I would have to repeat it 50 times to be sure, or include a lot more tests, basically, in that 6 month period. But the consistency of doing well each time was interesting to me. So did it improve my ability? I still think it's not enough information. I'd really want to do a lot more testing. And I would do it differently though, because this other weird thing that happened is cluing me into this. I think one time it was the day after I smoked the DMT. And in another instance, I think it was with psilocybin, hours later, my wife had driven me out of the house to go grocery shopping. Both those times, I believe I saw a UFO in the sky in daytime, right? Well, one was evening, sunset, the other one was daytime. I've seen them at night. I've been out with groups where you try and ask them to come, you know. So I've done that and seen things. These were daytime sightings. And that they happen to occur either hours after becoming sober or clear-headed after hallucinating, or the day after the DMT, that these occurred during that time frame. I wonder if the psychic window doesn't really open while hallucinating, but in the hours after or the day after, that might be when the window really opens up. So if I had the time, the energy, and the money to do this study again, and the participant team, I would redo it exactly the same, but with large doses, a larger team, of course, but have them take the ESP tests either hours later or the next day. I mean, right now in science, in research, they're understanding this. Psychedelics can reopen what's known as the critical period in the brain, which is open in childhood. So that's why kids can learn things so quickly. That's the critical window is open, and the brain will just learn whatever
Right.
really well, really quickly. So we grow older, we get set in our ways, the brain. But apparently, some research is showing that the critical window can be reopened for a period of time after taking a hallucinogenic. So, I mean, I've had this other experience that I write about that helps me think that is the case. It's that during the microdosing period, some part of my brain woke up and it was thirsty for music. And it drove me to learn several different instruments. They're basic instruments. It has to do with overtones, something about the harmonic frequencies. So like learning to play the mouth harp, to play the fujara. It's a Slovakian sheepherder flute, but it's hauntingly
Yeah.
beautiful. How to drumming, that has its own overtones. My brain, after microdosing, needed to hear music and needed me to produce music, that type of music. It haunted me. And it's as if that part of my brain had been shut down in childhood and now it's catching up. Like, I need to know music. So it's like the critical window, the critical period in my brain was reopened to music.
Yeah.
So, and since then, it seems to have closed down a little bit, but I can reopen it. Not necessarily by using psychedelics, but by playing music,
Yeah.
reopen. All I have to do is play my mouth harp for a few minutes, and it's like massaging my brain. I feel different. It almost feels like it took a little bit of a strong microdose.
Yeah.
Playing music can do that for me. And maybe professional musicians are like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock.
Yeah.
Playing music feels good. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
But like, I was behind my development, my brain development had been closed down to that aspect.
Yeah.
Psychedelics woke it back up. So,
Yeah, it's difficult to learn musical instrument as you get older. I started playing guitar and I was taking lessons, and the person I was taking lessons from, he taught by the song. So I just took a list of songs in that I wanted to learn. And, I struggled. And there was, and this is many several years ago, I took a little bit of LSD and sat outside in the back patio with my guitar. And it was Grateful Dead's Friend of the Devil. And I just sat there for hours. And much later, my guitar instructor told me, he's like, I was worried. I didn't think you were going to get it. He goes, but it was with Friend of the Devil. I don't know what happened, but something clicked with you. And I'm like, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what it was. But also, I want to kind of go back to what you were talking about in terms of doing the test again with the larger doses. One of the things, and I think I had mentioned this to you before, that I started thinking about is that under the influence of psychedelics, apparently the brain, it isn't that it's more active, but it quiets down. And if you think of the brain in terms of like a radio, where it's just filtering in the signals, if you quiet it down, more gets in. And it seems to me that in the stage where you have or can have hallucinations, there's probably too much going on. To steal, a little bit from one of your book titles, the signal gets lost in the noise. And it seems like the window to look at would be where the brain's still kind of open, but all of the noise is down a little bit more.
I think for me that was the case. I thought that maybe the psychic information would come in the hallucinations.
Oh, yeah.
But I realized, no, they're too noisy. That's not where it's at. And it trained
Yeah.
me, experiences trained me to look elsewhere. I had to move my attention around this cloud of hallucinations happening. I knew that that's not where it's at. Look around it. And it was almost like I had to look beyond the physical brain entirely into this
Yeah.
other space. And the hallucinations helped me to realize, don't look here, don't look in the ordinary thinking mind, the conceptual mind, it's not here, or the hallucinating mind, it's still in this other space, which you can learn by meditating. You don't have to do
Right.
hallucinogenics to
Yeah.
develop that ability, just meditation will do it. But I also think of this episode I saw of The Hollywood Medium. It's on Amazon Prime, I think, with that psychic medium, Tyler Henry. He's a young man. I mean, he's older now, but he interviews or he does mediumistic readings for people in Hollywood. And in the ninth episode, I think of the first season, he's doing a reading with one of the guys from, who are those guys from the 90s or 2000s who would do stunts, and they would like, they'd hurt themselves on purpose.
Oh, like Johnny Knoxville with
Yeah, I think it
Jackass.
was Jackass. And I think it
Yeah.
was Johnny Knoxville that he was doing a reading for. And Dr. Drew is there, and they put EK, not EKG, the EEG, EEG nodes on his scalp to take his brain readings while he's giving a mediumship reading. They found the same thing, that his brain basically dropped down into deep delta, super quiet state, while he's getting information from people who've died and crossed over. So, and I knew about that before I started this project. So that's what I was thinking, was maybe the hallucinogenics will affect my brain similarly to what he does when he's giving mediumistic readings. But it turns out not to be that way.
Yeah. Well, it also makes sense that even after the substance has kind of worked through a little bit, that there's still something open a little bit, that there is, and we know this from psychology that there are prolonged effects in terms of, like you had mentioned, not feeling depressed anymore. They have long going effects, so maybe that is the place to look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think psychic performance is improved by being in a state of relaxation and enhanced
Yeah.
creativity for sure.
Yeah.
Rather than being shut down, depressed, stressed out, anxious, all those things. So psychedelics still offer a lot of potential in
Yeah.
that realm.
Yeah. Well, I can't let you go without talking about the UFOs. So you mentioned that you had seen a couple of UFOs after having psychedelic experiences. And there are a few other places in your writings where you talked about them. So where do they fit in with the work that you're doing in terms of psychic abilities and out-of-body experiences? Where do they fit? How do they fit?
It's a big topic these days. The notion that the UFO or UAP phenomenon is a matter of consciousness. It's not just a matter of technology. These machines in the air are more than just machines. Maybe they're alive in their own way. But also, the reason why I include my writing about UFOs in this book and Dewdrops is to try and draw parallels. Why are UFOs connected to consciousness? Because a lot of people say that, and that's all you hear. It's all consciousness, man.
Right.
Well, how? Because that's,
Right.
it's just becoming a cliche, and it's empty and meaningless. How is it related to consciousness? And so I draw these very strong parallels that, for example, the way UAP and UFOs move through space matches the list of superhuman abilities or siddhis
Right.
that yogis can train in, you typically in Eastern traditions. For example, the ability to bilocate. Some UFOs have been seen to like go from one to two. Some UFOs seem to use telepathy to communicate with human beings or to read human beings' intentions. They can move through space, land, and water without a problem. And that's an ability. Like if you read the book, it's called the Path of Purification in English. It's the Visuddhimagga. It's a 5th-century meditation manual, typically used by certain Far East lineages of Buddhism, the Visuddhimagga. And it has a whole section. It's about 800 pages long. By the way, it's a big book with different paths of development and meditation. One of them is the supernormal powers. It is seen as a valid way to train to achieve nirvana, or cessation of suffering, to explore consciousness that way. So there it'll train you how to walk on water, how to fly through the air, how to move through mountains. It has instructions for how to train. Now the instructions are, they're not great. So that's why you really would need someone who can actually do it,
Yeah.
show you step by step how to do it. The book is not going to do that. But the book, that one, and other yoga books, the Sutras of Patanjali, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, He lists the powers there too. If you look at that list of powers, you see that they're the exact same behavior of UFOs, and that UFOs can appear out of nowhere and disappear into nowhere. That's what apports do. Like that blue piece of glass that appeared out of nowhere, suddenly it's here. That's what UFOs do. In the air, underwater, inside volcanoes, there's footage of UFOs entering volcanoes. How do they do that? It's the same thing. When we're doing telepathy, we're sending information from one being to another. Clairvoyance, we're gaining information. Like our minds are traveling. We can transcend past, present, and future with our minds. And there has been evidence and psychic tests to do that. If we look at physics, quantum physics, we see that there are particles of matter that are not matter anymore. There's just energy, but they seem to pop into and out of the past and the future in very, 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 very small moments of time. But they're not just lingering in the present moment, they're popping forward and backward across time. So, are the creators of these UFOs slash UAP, are they so developed in their consciousness ability that they're able to use it with technology or maybe without technology? Because some of these craft, they're just orbs of light. No, they're not a machine, there's something else. Are they so developed that they're really just using an extension of consciousness that meditators and yogis, religious figures have access to through their training? There's so many eyewitness accounts of people levitating. Like, I mean, there's so many. But now I'm blanking out. But there are eyewitness accounts recorded with the Catholic Church.
Cupertino, Saint
Yep, Saint Joseph
Cupertino.
of Cupertino, Saint Teresa, I think, also levitated. There are many saints who've been witnessed by hundreds and thousands of people to levitate, you know. And Milarepa was a Tibetan saint from the 10th century. Many people saw him flying through the sky, you know. I mean, there is a question there if he even existed, which I think is a problem with many historical figures, because the guy who wrote his life story wrote it a couple hundred years later. Like, did he really exist? Did anyone really see him, or is it a story? Still, that across cultural boundaries, across cultures, across society, across history, there seem to be many eyewitness accounts of people levitating, you know. So we can do on a very small level what UFOs appear to do. For us, it's consciousness and spirit. Who knows what it is for them? So that's why I bring it in, because I want to make that conversation deeper about how are UFOs and consciousness related? Well, here are some clues that they're operating on the same thing at a very deep, profound, sophisticated level of consciousness that most human beings are not tapped into, because we're basically in survival mode.
Now I'm thinking about the yoga of UFOs.
That's a great title. You got to write it. That book.
Well, I come up with good titles. But there is this tradition in, not just in New Age thought, but even in Western esoteric circles of people claiming to have communication with extraterrestrials of sorts. And like Aleister Crowley, the Book of the Law was channeled through a Iwas, I think the being's name was. And Robert Anton Wilson wrote about all of this as well. So there is a history. And I think that it's really important. And this is why I really appreciate, the work that you're doing and bringing this into the conversation. But also people like Jeff Kripal at Rice University and Diana Pasulka. Because they're recognizing that, look, if we're going to talk about spirituality and religion, people are having these experiences. And it is an unnecessary bias to say, well, no, we shouldn't look at them. We should. Because there are connections, like you mentioned, Saint Teresa, Saint Joseph of Cupertino. This is all part of the tradition. And it seems like, I don't know, maybe we just don't want to see it anymore. And people are like, nope. That's just not there. So I think it's really valuable. I think it's incredibly valuable to do.
And so many people are still burdened by being brainwashed into believing that the devil is behind anything that is not normally acceptable, where the demons are involved or it's evil. And if you look at it, it's going to open a door or something. A consciousness is like money. It can be a form of power, and it's up to the person to use it for good or bad. It's just a thing, like time and gravity. It's just a force. It's a presence. It's a tool, and it has effects. It's how you use it that can be used for good or for evil. It's not automatically evil just because it's woo-woo. People who've been raised in a certain church or their family has a belief system, humans are not particularly creative thinkers or open-minded thinkers. We just need to wait for people to die and get out of the way so that new beliefs can come to the fore. It's a slow process, unfortunately. Not that I want to die, but I'm just saying you can't change someone's beliefs. Only they can change it for themselves, and most people never will. So we just have to wait for people with new belief systems to come about.
Well, I don't even know if it's a matter necessarily of belief systems, but of what is considered legitimate points of inquiry. And I think in Western science and also Western religion, in many ways, consciousness has been off the table. And I think consciousness is kind of the anomaly because we're talking about consciousness, but the big question is, well, what in the world is it? And we're just now starting to ask that question. Whereas in India, the Buddhists and the yogis, they've been like, hold my beer. Not that they're going to have the beer, right? But they've been exploring this for a very, very long time. And we're just now starting to catch up.
I wonder how much of that is related to our, like, as a culture. I'll just talk about Americans in this decade. We're still very, I don't know if puritanical is the right word. That might not be an appropriate word, but like the nudity of the body is a shameful thing, And what could be more intimate than consciousness? Like seeing a naked body is pretty intimate, but that's on the physical. How about looking into someone's soul? I'll just use that word for this example. That's even far more intimate than the naked body. And some people are embarrassed by intimacy. They don't know, they weren't raised to be intimate people. And so to look inward so deeply and ask questions, oof, that's embarrassing. That's shameful. Don't know how to negotiate that. Better to just close that door and focus on watching the news and paying your rent,
Absolutely. Well, Sean, let me ask you the final questions. We've been at this for a little bit. I could talk to you longer, but I'll have to invite you back on at some point. But what do you have coming up? What are you working on next?
Yeah, so I've been training a small group of people in meditation. I'm developing a set of 50 meditation techniques to prepare someone to go on their first psychedelic journey, or if it's been a while, how can we take a very powerful experience and make it even better or really get the juice out of it? So this program is based off of my prior training in other traditions. So I've curated some of those meditation techniques. Some are directly inspired from what I've experienced journeying with LSD and psilocybin. And there's going to be a book with the techniques in there and other information and an online course with all 50 guided meditations on there, which a person could use the rest of their life if they wanted to. That's how that material is, to really turn what could be an okay experience into the most wonderful experience ever with deep spiritual and conscientious related insights coming out of it by preparing. And the meditations could be used as integration after the journey. And some of them could be even used during the journey, but that's for an experienced journeyer because it's enough to just lie there and the thing happens. So this is going to be called Path of the Golden Teacher. And the Golden Teacher is just a strain of Psilocybe cubensis. bit I'd like to title because it has a nice spiritual slant to it, but it is a path. It's inspired by the mushroom, non-religious. So I'm finishing up the program here over the next few weeks. I've been working with these people for months, getting their feedback, but now I want to release it to the public because there already has been conversation, especially in Buddhist circles. Is there room in Buddhism for psychedelics? And people should check out Mike Crowley, who you interviewed. So you've interviewed him. People should listen to that interview because he's a translator of different languages. He's done his research, and I agree with him that Buddhists and even people in other traditions have used psychedelics secretly, for sure, to have these very spiritual experiences that are written about, that people try and achieve through ritual and non-medicinal ways. But it's in the language, it's in the writings secretly that, yep, psychedelics are a very powerful way, if not the way that were in, that was initially used. So I want to bring that forward in a non-religious way. How do we mingle consciousness development through meditation with psychedelics? So that's what my focus is right now, and I hope to release it maybe by this fall. So if you want to check it out now, it's pathofthegoldenteacher.com. That's where they can find out more. But that's the thing. And then I always think that's going to be my last thing ever. I just want to go back to regular life. But that never lasts very long, like something else always comes along. So.
Well, I think that's really important because it seems, people are using the language that we are in a psychedelic renaissance. And I suppose we are, but this renaissance is being almost exclusively thought of in terms of psychology and mental health. And I don't want to minimize that because I think psychedelics have a huge role to play in that. But we also tend to ignore the spiritual aspect because they have been, I mean, like you said, Mike Crowley has talked about it in Buddhism. But even if we go back and look, in the Hindu tradition, you had soma, which most people think was some kind of psychedelic. And in the Zoroastrian, halma, and you had the Greek Eleusinian mysteries. And it's been there forever, So, and in some of the shamanic traditions. So I think it's really important to bring in that non-denominational spiritual aspect to it. So I look forward to that. Well, I'll have you back on. We'll talk about that when that comes out. All right. That was pathofthegoldenteacher.com. Okay. And then your main website is mindpossible.com, correct? Okay. Perfect. Well, I will put links for both of those in the show notes in the video description and probably put links in for a couple of your books so people can check them out. You've got several of them. So definitely put in Dewdrops of Infinity. And I liked your memoir, so I may put that one in too. It was a good read. It was a good, fun read. So anyway, Sean, thank you so much for your time. It was a total pleasure speaking with you.
You're welcome. I really had a good time talking to you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So until we speak again. And that's a wrap on episode 131 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media too, please. And subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing, all of that is really important. Right now, putting this podcast together is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but with your support, I can speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I do now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness and psychedelics, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.